Welcome to Legal Nurse Podcast, where you will get tips to expand your legal nurse consulting skills. Every week, you'll hear from experts from within and outside of legal nurse consulting. They will share their knowledge to help you grow. Your show is moderated by Pat Iyer, a legal nurse consultant with 30 years experience. So, join our community, sit back, relax, and get ready to learn. Here's Pat.
Hi, this is Pat Iyer with Legal Nurse Podcast, and I have the pleasure of bringing back to you Dr. Stephen Cohen, who is a specialist in the GI tract, and he is based in Richmond, Virginia, and provides the residents and interns and medical students with his experience as an assistant professor, associate professor, and also he is involved with the VA Medical Center in Richmond as a section chair. We've had Dr. Cohen on the show before, and it's always turned into a lively conversation. So I encourage you to sit back and enjoy and relax Dr. Cohen this morning. Welcome to the show, Stephen.
Thank you, Pat. It's a pleasure again to be back.
I know we chose as the topic for this podcast an issue that raises a lot of questions of dealing with inflammatory conditions of the bowel. And I know that this is something that occupies at least a portion of your professional time. Tell us, what are the controversies around, we'll take one condition, diverticulitis. And maybe for our listeners who haven't been thinking about the GI anatomy for a while, let's define that first for our listener.
That's a great place to start. So diverticulitis, as you know, is very, very common. But diverticulitis is really the infection that happens from having this diverticulosis. Diverticulosis, by definition, is not a problem. I have it, and I've not had a problem from it. They're outpouches of the bowel, large intestine, colon, usually on the left side, probably due and develop from maybe lack of fiber in the diet, constipation, straining, and it's common. How common is diverticulosis? 50% of 50-year-olds have these outpouches, 60% of 60-year-olds, and 70% of 70-year-olds. The fact that you have these little weaknesses in the wall of your colon doesn't mean you're going to have a problem. That's diverticulosis. However, if you get some hard stool stuck in these little pockets, that will cause a potentially micro-perforation, a little teeny hole, little bit of stool leaks out, that sets up the infection. That's what we call diverticulitis. Sometimes you can also have bleeding diverticulosis. That's not the infection, but it can cause massive lower GI bleed, sometimes requiring surgery. The issue comes up for a surgeon and or for a legal case is, does the patient need surgery? And we can talk about that in a second, about a specific case. And if surgery is done, was surgery done appropriately?
Is it ever possible that any of those little holes in the bowel that are associated with diverticulitis could get so large that the stool would leak out and cause peritonitis?
Yeah, and that's really the paradigm that we face as surgeons of what to do with the patient. And there is a classification system that really was developed in order for us to report these cases in the literature to compare similar patients to similar treatment options. Meaning, the classification system is called the Hinchey staging. It's stage 0 to 4. Stage 4, which is the worst, is fecal peritonitis. The hole is so big, there's stool in the abdomen. There's no doubt what needs to be done. That patient is sick, septic, resecting that part of the bowel and you're getting a colostomy. Nobody argues that. Stage zero is really microperforation with inflammation, no abscess, and a hole so small there is no stool leaking out. 95 to 99% of the time with medical therapy, not even in patients. Sometimes we can treat that as outpatient, antibiotics, cool you off, and you're fine. The middle stages, pericolonic abscess, a small abscess infection on the colon, pelvic abscess, bigger abscess, obviously, or purulent peritonitis, not frank stool, but pus in the abdomen. And depending on the stage, we make the decision of, are we treating you medical therapy? Do we percutaneously drain you with interventional radiology off, then operate on you 6 to 8 weeks down the line, avoiding the colostomy, or do you need emergency surgery?
So in terms of the standard of care issues that you've just described, what do you see as an expert witness that leads to liability around what we've just been talking about?
And that's a great question. Let's talk about a case that I was involved in. There is a 26-year-old gentleman with no past medical history whatsoever that presents to a hospital with a 3-day history of fever, abdominal pain, some nausea, no change in bowel habits, goes to the emergency room, has the fever's noted, has a white count of about 11,000, slightly elevated, tenderness in his abdomen, and they do a CAT scan. CAT scan is the gold standard test to look for intra-abdominal pathology. CAT scan is good for looking outside the bowel wall, not really good for looking inside the bowel, but it is the gold standard test for diverticulitis. We use it to look for appendicitis. The CAT scan in this 26-year-old showed microperforation, small hole, little bit of free air around the colon. He was admitted to the hospital, put on IV antibiotics. He is seen by surgeon in the group one who says, treatment is antibiotics. We're going to watch you. 3 days later, he gets better. White count normal. No fever. Abdominal pain is better. He is seen by surgeon number two, the partner, who says to the patient, gee, you're young. The chance of you having problems down the line is very high. I think you need surgery. Patient is not a doctor. Patient doesn't know the literature. Patient puts trust in doctor, agrees to surgery. Patient goes to surgery, has a colectomy, anastomosis. On day three, develops an acute abdomen, goes back to surgery, has a big hematoma, gets a washout. They close him. 5 days later, he gets better for a few days. 5 days later, septic again, back to the OR, big hole at the anastomosis, winds up with the colostomy. Right. So the question is, and anytime I look at a case, and I tell this to the residents, you're going to have complications in surgery. It's part of what we do. That's fine. But if and when you get a complication, the first question that anybody's going to ask is, did the patient need an operation? So when I was deposed in this case on the plaintiff side, I couldn't get past that the patient did not need an operation. I understand these complications are known complications of surgery. That's no trouble. But remember, standard of care is what a reasonable, prudent physician would do at the time facing this similar patient. Let's go back to diverticulitis. I have a 26-year-old with the first attack of diverticulitis with a Hinchey stage zero. He has inflammation, no pericolonic abscess, no fecal peritonitis, and wait a second, wait for it, he improved on medical therapy. What is the indication for surgery? He did mm-hmm. not need surgery. So remember, the other thing that's important that I tried to explain to the defense attorney, but he didn't want to hear what I was going to say, is outcome, and this is important, this comes up a lot, outcome is irrelevant in standard of care. I'm not looking at this case retrospectively, but when I'm standing at the bedside of a 26-year-old with an early stage diverticulitis, surgery is not indicated.
And he ends up with a life-altering surgery and irreversible. Correct. Lost his colon. Right. Now he's wearing a colostomy bag for the rest of his life with all the attendant problems associated with that.
Right. So again, now he needs another surgery to get his colostomy closed, which he will at some point. And that's fine because he's young. But now it's going to be the fourth time in his abdomen. It sets him up for scar tissue, adhesions, bowel obstruction, hernia, in an operation that he didn't need.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And during the deposition, the defense attorney wanted to continue to harp on the word judgment. And that drives me crazy. We do have judgment as surgeons. We do make judgments. But if and when that judgment falls outside the standard of care, that's a problem. There is no honest board certified colorectal surgeon that is faced with a 26-year-old patient with one attack of diverticulitis that's as hinchy early that improves with medical therapy that would have offered surgery. Part of the defense was the patient stated to surgeon two, he wanted everything done. So my comment to that was, I didn't see in the records where this patient went to medical school. How does he know what the everything being done is? The everything being done would have been, you're better. You're going to go home on antibiotics. 6 to 8 weeks, we're going to do a colonoscopy because you've never had one. We have to clear the colon of malignancy, unlikely in a 26-year-old, but that's still standard of care. And what's the chance he's going to get diverticulitis again? We used to think the earlier or the younger you are with diverticulitis, because you're going to live longer, you're going to get it again, and it's going to be a more virulent one, and it may perforate. We were taught that in the 80s and the 90s. We know better than that now. Just because you get diverticulitis in your 20s or 30s does not mean you're going to get it in your 50s, 60s, 70s, and it definitely does not mean it's going to be a worst case. In fact, it's probably going to be a more mild case because you already have some scarring around the colon, and you may not need surgery, but that's the opposite of what we were taught 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Something that you said sparked another question, and that is this: the concept of adhesions and lysis of adhesions. I've seen several cases where people had bowel injuries that were undetected in the OR because of the adhesions. We've gotten into the subject of adhesions because this young man is at risk for these in the future. Can you give us a perspective as a surgeon who's seen these adhesions? First of all, what do they look like? Legal nurse consultants see the words, but they don't see them in the bowel, in the body. Yeah. And what is the technique that should be used when a surgeon encounters them?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So I'm actually have some visual aids, and we weren't set up for this, but I happen to be sitting here with Kleenex, and this is what I tell patients. Adhesions are scar tissue that stick the bowel together. It makes surgery very difficult. There's no doubt. And we as surgeons have been there, you know, sometimes it takes me 3 or 4 hours to not even start the operation, to get through the scar tissue, to get down to the colon, to do what I was there for. And it's painful, but it's what we do. So what is scar tissue? In a normal bowel that's not had surgery, imagine two pieces of Kleenex that I put together. And if I operate operate on you and you've never had without any problem. Okay. Now imagine these same two pieces of Kleenex, me putting it underwater, hooking it back together, now trying to pull these Kleenexes apart that are wet without ripping it. Mm-hmm. Impossible. So that's the issue we face. It's tedious. It potentially can be hard to do. And we just do the best we can when we're done with surgery and we freed everything up to run the bowel top to bottom to make sure we don't miss those small little enterotomies, we call them, holes in the bowel, and we repair those. So it can be difficult. It is a known complication of surgery. And if you have a difficult operation like that and the patient's not progressing normally after surgery, the recognition or potentially going back to the OR to make sure there's not a problem is indicated at times.
Before we continue the podcast, please spend a few minutes getting to know one of the guest speakers who will be presenting at our September 23, 24, 25, 2021 Virtual Legal Nurse Consulting Conference. After you have a chance to meet this guest, we'll resume the podcast.
Wouldn't it be nice if everyone did everything the way that you wanted them to do it, when you wanted them to do it, how you wanted them to do it? Wouldn't that be a perfect world? But unfortunately, we have colleagues that overpromise and underdeliver. We have physicians and attorneys that don't respond to us. And even the most patient LNC can get frustrated. Well, the good news is I'm Jan Spence and I have solutions. So be sure to join me for my session at this upcoming LNC conference. It's those difficult people setting boundaries. In this high energy session, you're going to walk away with tips that you can use that day to help get back some of that control and be able to deal with these people in your world so that you can operate more efficiently and help them the way that you truly intend to. So be sure to register at https://lnc.tips/September2021virtual. Again, that's https://lnc.tips/September2021virtual. Be sure to register for September the 23rd through the 25th. You will see me in this high energy engaging session and you'll walk away with things that will make your life easier. I'm Jan Spence and I look forward to seeing you there.
Now you've had a chance to meet one of our esteemed speakers for our September 23, 24, and 25, 2021 Legal Nurse Consulting Virtual Conference planned by Barbara Levin and I for you. Be sure to get your seat reserved at this link, http://lnc.tips/September2021virtual. I'll see you there. And you just used a phrase that I have seen in many operative reports, which is run the bell. Mm-hmm. Tell our listener or our viewer, what does that mean?
So we all have about 23 feet of small intestine and about 5 feet of large intestine. Running the bowel means we look at it inch by inch, centimeter by centimeter at all sides to make sure we haven't injured anything. And that's running the bowel. We do it if we're at the end of a procedure to make sure we haven't missed an enterotomy. We do it if we're looking for either metastatic disease or any lesions in the bowel. We're normally, the way it's dictated is the bowel was run from ligament of trites to ileocecal valve. Ligament of trites is a small little band that separates the duodenum, right? It goes esophagus, stomach, the duodenal sweep, and then you begin the jejunum. There's a fibrous band that separates the duodenum jejunum that actually attaches to the diaphragm, and it's a structure, ligament of trites, so you can touch it and feel it. From that point all the way down to the ileocecal valve, about 23 feet, that's the valve that we look at. The part of the duodenum is retroperitoneal around the pancreas, so we kind of stay away from that. The rest of the bowel is inside the abdomen. That's what we look at.
I have also worked on cases, Stephen, when maybe there was an enterotomy or maybe there was an anastomosis of the bowel. And then that suturing or that stapling comes apart. And you've got those two pieces of bowel that are disconnected, dumping stool into the abdomen, creating all kinds of trouble. Is that leak or that rupture of the anastomosis, is that by virtue of the fact that it happened, is that automatically a liability issue?
That's a great question. And I get asked to review that all the time. That's one of the more common ones. The answer is definitely no. That is not an automatic liability issue. When we talk to patients about risks of surgery, I can't possibly tell them every possible weird, unusual complication. In general, what I tell patients, there's one of six things that can happen to you when I operate on you, especially when you're removing a piece of bowel and hooking it together. There are known complications. Most of them you all know: bleeding, infection, anesthesia complications. I can make you worse. I can injure another organ, or you can die. Those six things, what I tell the residents, that encompasses any weird thing that could potentially happen. It's not the actual complication that most of us get sued for or the cases that you are all reviewing. It's really the failure to recognize such a problem. It is a known complication. If I'm taking out a piece of the bowel and hooking it together, that it can leak. And it depends on what part of the bowel. We can look back at the literature and tell you the percentage wise. Small bowel to small bowel anastomosis or hand sewn or stapled, doesn't matter, 1-3%. Colon, right side of the colon, ileocolic anastomosis, 3-5%. The farther you go around the colon down to the pelvis, the rectum, 7-12% chance of a leak. So I know that going in. Even the best surgeons in the country, nobody has 0% complications. If you tell me you're not having complications, either you're lying to me or you're not operating. There's one of two choices. It's funny. When I was with a group of eight other colorectal surgeons, one day we were having this discussion and I asked everybody in the room, what do you think collectively, the nine of us, all board certified colorectal surgeons, the senior guy had been doing it for 25 years, the young guy had been there for 3 or 4 years, we all were doing 120 maybe colectomies a year. What do you think our leak rate is? 3%, 4%, 5%. I went back and looked. We were about 8%, right? The national average. We're no better than anybody else, but that's expected. Mm-hmm. Knowing that you can have this complication, if and when the patient has objective data, day 1, 3, 5, 7, not progressing normally as you would expect, you have to have the heightened awareness, check for it, fix it. It's the delay in diagnosis that leads to sepsis that can create a disaster for the patient, possibly death. That's where the medical legal issue comes in. Don't ignore the tachycardia. Don't ignore the white count that went from 3-7-12-25. Don't ignore the stool leaking out of the drain. Those are the things that we get asked to review because they let the patient sit for 3 days. But you know there's a chance it can leak. Why did you ignore it? And that's a whole separate topic of why.
Yes, yes. And I think we're paying a lot better attention now to signs of sepsis and getting antibiotics started and recognizing it. But the why is fascinating because is it a middle of the night issue, or is it, God forbid, July 1st and the residents are switching over, or is it the beginning of a 3-day weekend, or is it an arrogant staff member who's associated with this problem. I sit and I wonder about those things because they don't show up in the medical record as this was a problem because it's Friday evening on the July 4th weekend. From working in the healthcare system, what are some of those factors, or from reviewing cases as an expert, what are some of those subtle things that we're talking about that influence a delay in diagnosis?
Well, and you hit on many of them, but the one most important one that you did not touch on is the partner covering for the doctor who actually did the operation. Mm-hmm. Remember, because that happens a lot. Surgery's done on Wednesday, Thursday. The partner is covering on the weekend, doesn't know the patient other than a verbal sign out, hey, I did a colectomy, the guy's doing fine, do the usual stuff on the weekend. Right. Then he starts getting sick on the weekend. For some reason, that's a very common scenario where partner number two, who's just covering, doesn't know the patient, wasn't there in surgery, doesn't know the peculiars, kind of manages it to keep the patient going till Monday morning. That's common.
I can think of times, Stephen, that I have spent time on the phone talking to a covering physician when I was working as a staff nurse and going through the litany and explaining the patient to the covering physician and getting this sense of I'm hitting this total blank wall.
Yeah.
And the physician on the other end is waiting for me to tell him or her, what is it that I want them to do?
Right.
Grasping for those facts to be able to then come up with a coherent response. And, you know, if I sit back and I empathize with what that's like, what that must be like, you know, I can think of how awkward it would be to be in that situation of not knowing the person and not understanding the nuances of what's going on. And I'm sure you've been in that because you've covered for other people.
Absolutely. And it's the worst thing is that when you have your partner's patient not doing well after surgery and making the decision of what you can do. I will tell you, as the years gone on, it's much easier to make the decision to either reoperate or get somebody else involved, depending on what the situation is. Because once I am covering for my partner's patient at 5:01 on Friday afternoon, and I'm covering till Monday morning at 5:00 in the morning, it is my responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one of the things that we tell the residents. If you don't give good sign out and your documentation is not good, it's all those things that come into play. And you've been around long enough, that's where things get missed. It's the nights, it's the weekends, and it's not knowing the patient because you don't have the patient relationship. You're just covering. Most of the time, the patients do well and go home. It's easy to be a doctor when everything goes right. But when something goes wrong, then it's time to put on the big boy and big girl pants and do the right thing, even though it's your partner's patient. And a lot of times it's the younger partners taking care of the senior partner's patient that does not want to make the decision, even though they know it's the right thing. And I cannot tell you the number of times that's happened.
There's a case that I have shared with nurses to teach them how to write chronologies involving a patient who went in for a diagnostic laparoscopy, and in the process of doing the surgery, the surgeon went through the uterus and into the inferior vena cava. And the younger surgeon was concerned because he could see blood coming into the operative field and said to the older surgeon, you know, I'm seeing blood. And the older surgeon says, oh, she's had endometriosis. It's old blood. Don't worry about it. He was in a rush to get out so he could go play golf. And the younger surgeon didn't have enough chutzpah to say, hey, wait a minute, this isn't right. The reason that the case blew apart was that there was a sales rep for this needle. It was a Varis needle who was in the OR. And I pointed out to the attorney, you see how it says here that she was present? We need to get her deposition and find out more about what she observed. And she gave us this whole dialogue that she overheard being in the OR, watching the dynamics between these two surgeons. I can see how it would be very challenging for a younger surgeon to confront an older, more experienced person who had authority over them to say, no, this isn't right. I mean, how do you teach residents and interns how to speak up? Because to me, that's one of the most awkward conversations that I can imagine that would occur.
Well, I mean, I think it just comes with the teaching and the training and the educating. And especially when we're at the VA, we try to give them autonomy and try to get them to make the decisions rather than spoon feed them. And I think that's part of the issue. In certain training programs, even ours, it's to some respect at the main hospital, they're just being told what to do. And all of a sudden, now you're in charge. And it's hard to speak up if you've never been put in that situation. So giving them autonomy, making them think on their feet, making them come up with a decision. Of course, if it's wrong, we teach them, but you got to be at that position. And again, I say this to the residents as well. When I was at my VA in Boston training, it was when they gave me enough autonomy that finally the light bulb went off in my head that I think I could actually do this job because they let me do it. And I was the doctor. So a lot of it is the training, you know, it's not perfect. And I think, you know, they don't spend as much time as Dr. Cohen did in the hospital, obviously, because of the residency hours, but it's a teaching and training and education thing. But if you're going to be the surgeon and if you're covering on the weekend and if something is not right, to not do something is definitely not standard of care, which can lead to disaster.
Yeah, standard of care is not different whether it's Saturday at 4 or it's Monday at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It's what are the clinical findings, what's warranted, who do you consult? What studies do you order? You know, the delay in diagnosis of bowel ruptures, of appendicitis, of abscesses, of bleeding, they have enormous consequences.
Correct. Yeah. And it can lead to permanent colostomy, deformity, and death. And we've all seen that.
Mm-hmm. You and I could talk about this all day, but we won't. How can our listener who is listening to this on our audio channels or watching this on our YouTube channel, which is Legal Nurse Business, how can they find out more about you, contact you if they have a case that requires your skill as an expert witness? What would be the best way for them to do that?
Well, definitely my email. I mean, it's Stephen Cohen, Stephen with a PH, 615 Gmail. I am on LinkedIn. Under Stephen Cohen, it's my face. You can't miss it. Okay. But that's probably the best way. Certainly I'm available to either review and I will give you an honest opinion. Unfortunately, about 30% of the time, the plaintiffs that call me, they don't like my answer because it's not a breach in the standard of care and their known outcomes. You know, I get asked to review a lot of perforations from colonoscopic polypectomies. And as we know, that is a known complication. And if it's recognized in a timely fashion and fixed, unfortunately, that's not a breach in the standard of care. But those are probably that's the best way to get me. LinkedIn, people have reached out to me on that before.
Right. And let me spell out your email. It's S-T-E-P-H-A-N.
No, E-N.
E-N. Thank you. Stephen, S-T-E-P-H-E-N 615@gmail.com.
Correct. Stephen Cohen, C-O-H-E-N 615@gmail.
Yeah, I really slaughtered that, didn't I?
It's okay.
Do it one more time, Stephen.
It's Stephen Cohen, Stephen's with S-T-E-P-H-E-N C-O-H-E-N 615. That's my birthday, just in case. gmail.com.
I had a child who was born on June 11th, so I understand that time of the year. Wonderful. I appreciate what you have shared in your program. I know that You have experience as a clinician, as an expert witness, and you've been a wonderful resource for legal nurse consultants as they have encountered cases in which these issues arise. We're talking about an area where there could be potentially a lot of things that can go wrong. And not all of those bad outcomes, as we've been talking this morning, are due to failures to follow the standard of care, but can be complications and outcomes that weren't preventable or were detected and corrected quickly with less injury to the patient. And thank you to you who's been watching this program on our YouTube channel. Be sure to come back next week, new guest, new topic, or click on down for the next podcast in this series and tell another legal nurse consultant about Legal Nurse Podcast. We started in September of 2016 and continue to be the premier legal nurse consulting podcast. Thanks so much. This is Pat Iyer with Legal Nurse Podcast. Jill Gunther is with me today, who works in an obstetrical unit in a hospital in New York State. And we've just been talking about the area of law that contains great risks for plaintiff attorneys, for defense attorneys, and for the mothers and babies who receive care in the obstetrical area. Jill, what were some of the key topics that we covered in your podcast?
We talked about various risks for mom, not just the delivery room, but the postpartum. Hemorrhage is a big risk for mom. We talked about that. We talked about clots. Blood clots are a big risk for mom. We talked about preventative measures. We talked about amniotic fluid embolism, and then the differences a little bit between how you would handle blood clots versus amniotic fluid embolism. Then we spent some time talking about how COVID is affecting the staff in the unit, staffing ratios, education, new staff coming into the unit, and concerns that might be related to those things.
We covered a lot of territory and we just scratched the surface, Jill. There are so many aspects of care and obstetrics that are changing, that are important, and rely on great assessment skills and the ability to think critically, which we both know impacts how medical legal analysis occurs. Be sure to catch Jill Gunther's podcast as we talk about some of the risks in the postpartum area and tell another legal nurse consultant about Legal Nurse Podcast.
We hope you enjoyed today's episode. Check out Pat Iyer's resources for legal nurse consultants on LegalNurseBusiness.com. Pat coaches legal nurse consultants so they make more money, get more clients, and avoid expensive mistakes. Check out her coaching program at LNCAcademy.com. Please subscribe to our podcast and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Join our community to get notified of each new episode and to receive the transcript of today's program. Complete the request form on podcast.legalnursebusiness.com. We appreciate you and your interest.